Welcome to Season 10, Episode 6 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk about our favorite classes and archetypes. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 6 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Greetings and salutations.
Yeah, Paul hasn't been able to. He keeps coming up with reasons not to be able to join us. I hope that he will be able to soon, because he surely is missed.
Absolutely. Not even disagreeing in the slightest.
So, oh, man, 2 weeks. It's hard to believe 2 weeks has passed. But I guess the big news... Let's hit a little bit of the news, which the big news was, of course, the Pathfinder beta has been announced for second edition, or playtest, or whatever you want to do. Depending on how you feel about that, I understand why Paizo is doing this. They're, with the release of 5th edition D&D, I think their sales are lagging a little bit.
Well, I'm not disagreeing there. It definitely has been a change of focus. Plus, even additions, you run out of things to say. Well, it's not a problem when it comes to your things. Your game is perfectly playable before. But you could definitely tell a game gets nearer, for lack of a better term, its marketable lifespan when you start writing books that kind of regurgitate old ground, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, you know, but it's funny because this is also the complaint I have about new versions, where at a certain point, depending on how different the version is, there's a lot of retread on material that you've already published.
Yeah.
You know, which I always think is, I understand it because especially if the rules have changed significantly. Now, I don't know how significant their changes are going to be. I know that they went into a few on their first look. It sounded like they're, in some ways, they're taking some of what 5th edition has, you know, in certain aspects, you know, just from the quick read that I did from their website on something. Mm-hmm. So I don't, you know, and on the other hand, but they can't actually use 5th edition because, well, none of that was part of the old license that obviously Pathfinder was originally created under.
Oh, definitely. Like, again, they basically held the banner for 3.5 D&D for 10 years longer than expected, for lack of a better term. And if you think about it, if you include Pathfinder as the extension of 3rd edition, it's been running for 18 years. You know, they've done all the permutations. They basically built a brilliant marketing scheme where they kept a lot of the Grognards when they switched over to 4th edition. And they managed to get a lot of their stuff there, you know. This is going to be the real test. Like, I have absolute faith in Lisa Stevens' ability to market, because she managed to pull two different rabbits out of her hat at two different eras. You know, she was one of the people originally responsible for World of Darkness, and she's responsible for the success of Pathfinder. So I'm kind of curious to see where it leads and just see the different transformations here. And, well, I'd be interested in seeing people who are a little bit more knowledgeable about the facts than I am. I might do a little bit of research just to see what exactly is happening here, because it's going to be like, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if Starfinder acts a lot like Star Wars Saga did when they went from 3rd to 4th, you know, here's a kind of a semi beta test just to try out new ideas and concepts.
Yeah. It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. Basically, I guess they're going to have some sort of... They're saying that the final product will be released in August of 2019. That's their plan.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I don't know. One of the more interesting things is, I guess they've decided, instead of calling... They decided to call it Ancestry instead of Race for some reason. I'm not sure exactly where that goes, except for, in some ways, it opens the door for the possibility of things like, instead of, you know, instead of it just being like race, elf, human, whatever, it could be, you know, like, let's face it, you know, in the modern day, someone who's from Scotland is going to have a completely different outlook than, say, and possibly skills and other things that go along with that than somebody else.
Yeah, I'm imagining ancestry is basically a way to try to combine both races and backgrounds into the same category in a lot of ways.
I think so.
Yeah. So, you know, like, I could see it being used for something like Pendragon. Like, let's say your ancestry is, you have a lineage that's 2,000 years old. And you could send it from a long line of noblemen. Maybe that's your choice instead of playing, say, an elf or a dwarf. And might even change the character concept. But, of course, I'm kind of talking out of here a little bit here.
Yeah, like I said, I mean, we only have what they've told us. I think certain things are, apparently they're going to have a new initiative system, you know, is something that's been said. I know that they're probably going to combine a few more skills.
Yeah, it sounds like they're going to try to be more condition-based when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah.
And try to limit it, which kind of makes sense because it helps streamline the system. Like, you know, you can see the change of the system when they started just simply having it so you more or less roll against AC and you don't have to worry about all the weird edge cases and conditions, you know? Like, the original range touch attack, doesn't... I'd be interested in seeing if it survives the actual toucher. Because it looks like flat-footed is now a condition, which makes sense, but, you know, kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the weirdest thing, not weirdest, but here's they have, so hit points are going to come from your ancestry, your class, and then your constitution modifier is what they're saying. And so I guess first level characters are going to have more hit points.
Yeah. Well, if they can flatten the curve, because, you know, like, hell, even in 5th edition, I've heard published game masters, and hell, when I did my own 3rd edition work, if you had a 10 hit point buffer at first level, it actually flattens the curve a great deal. And if you flatten the iconic spells after about 11th level or spell, so you might get more mileage out of your game instead of that sweet spot, which in original 3rd edition was 3 to 10.
Yeah.
You know, like, anything lower than that, you were basically playing, how can I live long enough to get to 3rd level? And after that, you were basically in an arms race with the GM, where you were basically deciding what items could be used to, you know, you were almost playing a meta game at that point. Like, aha, I have this. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to respond. The GM's going to respond this way. And while that can be fun, it takes away from the actual feel of the game. So I'd be interested in seeing what they're going to do to extend the curve.
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's interesting that when they're talking, originally, what I originally read, and I think a lot of people thought, when one of their posts is, they thought the skill proficiency is going to be a lot more like 5th edition.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently what they're talking about is that there's only 5, you know, classifications, it looks like, from this article that you showed me, where it's like,
yeah,
the skill is going to be untrained, where you're at a -2 penalty, trained is just +0, expert at +1, master at +2, and legendary at +3.
Well, it does flatten the curve, and that way you don't have to be on the treadmill as much, but, you know, if you keep up math, which is, I guess that's a 5th edition change when they switch from 4th to 5th, is to flatten the mass, so to speak. But
yeah, that's one of the weird things I told someone about 5th edition that I didn't really care for, was, so everyone has the same proficiency bonus. I kind of get that, but mm-hmm. that proficiency bonus is a single bonus, and that's what you use to help to hit.
Yeah.
So barring anything else, everyone pretty much at first level has the same to hit bonus, which seems weird to me just because I'm so used to fighters having a higher hit chance than clerics and thieves and, you know, any sort of wizard or magic user type.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that always throws me. Now, I understand that, okay, well, the fighters get all these additional abilities, which kind of gives them additional bonuses and other things. I get that. But I'm just saying, from a raw to hit chance, from using nothing else, they're the same. And that just seems weird to me.
I can see that. But I think that was also part of the compensation where you had rules benders. Like, Wizards done right never, well, they could throw hit points and you'd have a saving throw of some sort, but basically the saving throw was their domain more so than the actual to hit. Like, I don't need to roll to hit because my hit actually kind of sucks, but you have to make a save against my ability or something horrible happens. So, like a 6 of 1, 1.5 dozen of the other. Or you have the stuff like flat-footed or ranged touch attack and so forth to kind of compensate, you know, for a lot of the classes. Like, there's been at least 6 different reiterations, as far as I know, of sneak attack. And they've all played a little differently as we learn new stuff. So...
it's going to, honestly, I think they're just, it's going to be a different game. And I think, you know, I think part of it is that they've outgrown what they originally planned to do with Pathfinder, which has become the de facto 3.5 replacement.
Yeah. And I think they did a very successful job of that. But
now they're in a position where they have to do something else because what they've always claimed they've been good at, well, which was selling adventures.
Yeah.
And, you know. If no one's playing your game, then no one's buying your adventures.
That is true. And it kind of reminds me of what happened with Kenzerco back in the early 2000s, where thanks to some weird loss, you know, basically a lot of negotiations and so forth, Packmaster 4th Edition was actually compiling a 1st and 2nd Edition because they were able to get the rights and privileges because they managed to get their... they basically published those Dragon magazines in the CD and Magic had access for quite a few years. And then when they lost their license, because, you know, they only had a limited time to have access to that, they had to totally rebuild the game from the ground up using a tick-based system. And this is reminding me a lot of that. So I hope, I wish them luck in their endeavor.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. So, all right, so we get into the talk, I guess, which is our favorite classes and archetypes. I mean, this can go a lot of different ways.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, let's go with the granddaddy. Let's go with genre, fantasy, and I mean, if you want to just get game specific, we can go Dungeons and Dragons / Pathfinder.
Okay.
You know, probably favorite class.
Okay. Okay. I guess it. Big question is, do we go, you can go by basic archetypes, like, or you can go for the subclasses and so forth.
Yeah, I don't really care.
Yeah, so I'll be blunt. Same. One of my favorite classes of all time, two of them actually are complete and utter heresy in a lot of editions. I love the Warlord, and I love the Sword Mage.
Okay.
Like, I really like the idea of playing essentially a growing up version of Julius Caesar or Charlemagne, who probably isn't the greatest fighter in the world, but they have the ability to change the battlefield and give bonuses out. And I think that's one of the neatest concepts because you can play it all sorts of different ways. You can play it like, you can play it as the damsel in distress, but instead of actually being physical there, you're giving true martial bonuses whenever you say do something or something to that effect, which explains why you're there. Or you can build a kobold cheerleader. So, you know, basically, or you can, like, there's this Japanese concept where you basically wear flags. I can't remember the exact name. But you do it to basically act as cheerleaders for other events, and it's actually kind of a competitive work, you know, where they basically try to psych up a group to do better, and then when they fail, you feel like you failed.
Huh.
What it's called. Fortunately, I don't have to. I think I have it written down somewhere.
Yeah, because I have no idea.
Okay. Okay, yeah, so that's one of my favorite concepts. And I don't know, maybe it's because you get old after a certain point and you start having certain opinions. But I've become a real grognard when it comes to multi-classing. I kind of prefer having a class that's designed from the ground up when it comes to doing something. So I don't want a fighter mage. I want an actual dedicated spellcasting fighter that actually is comparatively balanced, just so you don't end up fighting with everything.
Right. You know, and I'm actually not a big fan of multi-classing either. I always people like, well, I'm going to take a level of fighter here and a little of this there. And I'm just like, yeah, but it's like I prefer just straight up doing a single class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so for me, there are three.
Okay.
Let's face it, probably first up, Wizard. I've always been a big fan of Wizards. It's one of the reasons I always liked Dungeons & Dragons in the first place. You know, I had a medieval thing, but I always liked the idea of magic. So it's like, yeah, Wizard. You know, of course, in first edition, they were just called magic users.
Mm-hmm.
That's how old school I am. You know, and I mean, it's weird watching them in editions where, you know, like, obviously Pathfinder 3.5 or even D&D 5th edition, it's like, wow, you know, you get to actually have some attack spells that you pretty much get to use all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's comparative to when I first started, where it's like, here, I cast Magic Missile or Sleep, I'm done. You know?
Absolutely.
What was that?
Absolutely. Like, well, let's be honest, D&D is one of its main focuses, has always been magic, and the wizard archetype is so iconic now that it's basically become the, I don't know, because it's kind of almost a creation of its own appeal in a lot of ways, because they built it along the Vatican system done by Jack Vance, and they basically made it more concept-based. Like, there's always been an idea of having a spellcaster in the party of some sort.
Right.
But the wizard is his own beast, for lack of a better term. You know, that plays on its own merits. Like, you're playing a rules bender. Because 9 times out of 10, you're able to do something that's an exception because you cast a funky spell. And that's a good thing.
Right. So, probably in that category, my second favorite is probably the Druid.
I could see that.
You know, I've always liked the... I won't say I'm an actual outdoorsman, but I like the outdoors. So I've always kind of liked the Druid. And I've always liked the Druid over the Ranger. You know, there's a lot of people like, well, the Ranger has outdoor skills. Yeah, but you could argue that, at a certain level, the Ranger, outside of tracking, and depending on what edition you're in, he doesn't really have that many outdoor skills, usually. I mean, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, because the strangest thing is I've played games where, like, Rolemaster, where it's like, okay, you get to choose any skills you want as long as you pay the development cost for those skills. Where it's like my fighter was a better outdoorsman than the Ranger ever will be.
Yeah, there's a bit of a fight in the concept and the idea. Like, the Ranger's always kind of felt like a hodgepodge or an Aragon concept, but...
Well, I mean, that's what they're trying to model 90% of the time is, you know, Aragorn.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole... I mean, let's face it. I mean, it's like... And, of course, what, like... I forget what edition it started. All of a sudden, it's like, well, you can choose basically the archery path or the two-weapon path. Why do you have to? That makes no sense.
Well, I think it's kind of funny because when I think of Ranger, I think of Robin of Loxley. You know, the original, the basic concept of the Ranger. However, I've noticed a lot lately that I've been getting pushback on that concept, and it's not just from one place. It's been from multiple locations. Where the idea that playing essentially Robin Hood isn't a ranger anymore. And if he's not a ranger, then I don't know what a ranger is. I'll be blunt.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of those concepts that just sort of changing there. Whereas a druid, you're playing one who literally is one with nature. And I guess the bouncing between spellcasting and shapeshifting is just such a scary combination in any edition.
Yeah, and you know, it's just, well... And, you know, I've played druids when they didn't have very many shape-shifting capabilities, you know, way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, I mean, it's like I've always kind of just, I like the idea of them. And I remember this one article I read about druids, and I'm like, yeah, that I like that idea where they were kind of like, the best way to describe them is it's like, you know, a druid is kind of a weird, you could be considered like a weird little wandering priest for nature that just does things, you know, for people. It's like, you know, it's like he's the kind of guy that will show up in a town and it's like, oh, your crops are failing, well, maybe I can help you with that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, yes, he's protecting the wilderness or something along those lines. It's a more, I don't know, it just always felt like a more complete concept of a character rather than, oh yeah, you know, like you said, the ranger.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh, definitely. I'm actually a bit of a sucker for one other class, the rogue.
I would. Like, I was going to say the Rogue is probably my my out of the three. That's my least. I mean that you know, I was saying there was three. That was probably that's in my top three.
Yeah.
You know, just because you get to climb walls, you get to do, especially, you know, it sounds weird, but especially when they change from Thief to Rogue, it kind of like, well, that makes a little more sense. You know, you can have someone who's a little bit more. I almost want to say, if I had to choose something that wasn't quite, that was a wasn't a Rogue, but was in some cases kind of similar, I guess I've always seen the Rogue as more of a semi-swashbuckler.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing there, but basically making him the light fighter build and the sneaky guy.
Yeah.
And by changing him from Thief to Rogue, you can open up a lot of different options that weren't normally available.
Right.
Plus,
right.
I get an absolute twisted glee when I beat somebody who spent a lot more money or expense or items with a few choice skills and a few choice words. Like, nothing quite like watching a wizard suddenly realize that he's in a trap that he himself set off. Okay. You know, kind of the idea that you outsmarted your opponent, the guy that's supposed to be Mr. Smarty Pants or Mr. Magic Incarnate, especially when you're in a basically magic is core for D&D.
Yeah. And I mean, that's not to say, of course, that I haven't played other classes, other races. And especially with archetypes, I have to say almost all my archetypes are typically human. I don't typically go for a lot of, that's just me.
That's fair.
A lot of the races, I know some people who are in love with elves, so they play a lot of elves. And, you know, to a certain degree, you can. There's a bunch of archetypes just for elves, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I can see that.
But, yeah, I like playing the more human-type characters.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because, I know this is going to sound weird, but I always feel like I really don't understand how an elf might think, or even I don't even have like a checklist to go by. You know, other people, they think they know how elves think, and it's like, I play elves. Okay, there you go. That's what you want. I have no problem with that. I mean, I knew a guy that he would play dwarfs, even in games that had no dwarfs.
Cute.
No, I'm serious. It's like you hear him describe his character, and it's like, that's a dwarf, but he's not a dwarf. You know.
Yeah. Well, again, you get into, for lack of a better term, you have comfort characters. And that's kind of what we're talking about today. The ones that, if you have a choice, you'll fall back on when it comes to a lot of ideas here. And I ain't gonna lie to you, I'm kind of the opposite post when it comes to that sort of thing. Like, the book that really drew me into D&D, like, before I was, you know, I played a few characters here and there, but of course it was the second edition Humanoids Handbook. And I've written books about dinosaur people and minotaurs that have actually been published in the GM's Guild. I think I have a certain enjoyment when it comes to trying to build a non-human culture and trying to figure out how they tick. And, well, I'm not going to say that, you know, heck, I even created even weirder stuff when it comes to things here. Even if you got to be careful to avoid the race of hat syndrome. You know, like in Star Trek, where you have all Vulcans are logical, all Klingons are basically warlike, all Romulans are sneaky, and a lot of it's basically shorthand for a lot of those basic archetypes and concepts.
Oh, that's true. I mean, even the, you know, definitely when you look at some of the races, that's kind of the way they were originally designed. You know, I mean, it's kind of weird when you look at like some of the other editions of D&D, especially if you take the D&D that was the rule cyclopedia.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, there's a dwarf. That's the class/profession/race. And halfling was the same way, and so was elf. And you're just like, well, that's weird. You know?
Well, I always find it kind of weird on D&D cyclopedia, and I'm actually impressed it really worked really well, is how races had a level limit. In a game where you could play up to level 36 before you got into the Immortal Worlds. And a lot of them buttoned up at, what was it, halflings were level 8? It's been a while.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Though, if you actually have the rule cyclopedia, in the back they talk about the options to actually let those races actually level up to, like, level 36 as well.
Okay.
that was just a weird option, and they talk about the progressions and for a whole bunch of things, and it's like, you know, I think like the elves, they would continue getting certain spells, and then their hit chances was basically the equivalent of a cleric.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of sort of thing, which was fascinating, because, you know, the elves were kind of always fighter magic users, period.
Yeah, they were the Gish class, basically. And what's even weirder is a buddy of mine once did something that I always found very interesting. He assumed that all elves, all clerics were elves if you're trying to play a more Tolkien-type game, because they kind of fill that same niche in Tolkien's writing. You know, their magic isn't exactly high-powerful, but it does act a lot of as the healers of the group in a lot of the different tales in both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings.
Huh.
So he kind of did that spin on there and basically worked on the assumption that any cleric you had isn't actually a cleric of a god. It's actually just an elf with an incredibly long lifespan who channels essentially nature with, it's essentially a reskin of the concept. And when I heard that, I had to try a cleric out, obviously, in the right world. And it was actually a lot of fun just trying that. Okay.
That's interesting. So let's switch over to something. Let's switch over to like some sort of science fiction, more
sure.
space opera-ish science fiction.
Okay.
And I mean, that opens a whole realm, because there's a lot of different possibilities here.
Okay.
Well. I mean, so I guess I'll start on this one. So I'm a big traveler guy. I love,
mm-hmm.
I think Traveler's one of those weird universes where there is the Imperium, which is the so-called, almost the shared universe that most people tend to operate under at some level.
Yes.
But it's also one of those universes, and I think I've said this before, where everyone realizes that they're all going to have their own take on that universe, and no one's right.
That's true.
You know, so there's always been this concept in my Traveler universe, IMTU.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my Traveler universe, this is how things operate. You know, in somebody else's universe, it might operate a little differently. You know, where, you know, there will be some people who run their Traveler universe where the Imperium is kind of has a very high bureaucracy and they don't give a shit, where other people said, well, the game is a little more benevolent, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and stuff like that. So, because of Traveler, I have to say, my personal favorite kind of archetypes are the scout / explorers in any type of science fiction space game. Those are always the kind of characters I've always gravitated towards, you know. In some ways, it's funny because they're almost what I would expect Rangers in D&D to be, but they're not.
Yeah.
You know, which is the grand irony, you know, because it's like, hey, wait a minute. These guys are, you know, the explorers, and especially like in Traveler, a lot of times they already know how to pilot a small starship,
mm-hmm.
you know. So a lot of times they kind of feel like this pilot
yep.
niche already. So mm-hmm. I mean, but yet they're survivalists. They're survivors.
Yep.
You know, they're those type of people. It's like, for them, there's always one more thing I can do to solve this problem. Oh, that didn't work. There's one more thing I can do.
Yeah. Basically become almost a wilderness version of MacGyver. Hey, let's try this. Oh, wait, we have this. Let's try that.
Well,
no, it makes perfect sense.
I mean, in a Traveler, they always, you know, the scout characters always had access to the jack-of-all-trades skill, which was always like a weird catch-all. And depending on which version of Traveler you're playing, either allows you to do things that you don't have skills for, or in some editions, it gave you additional retries at stuff. Because you have this, you're a jack of all trades, so it's like you're able to access resources that normally people wouldn't use. But I can fix it with some, you know, so they get another attempt at, say, like a repair roll.
Makes sense to me. And sometimes there's a lot of things that are incredibly useful, but only in very specific situations, and jack of all trades would probably fill that hole, so to speak.
Yeah. So,
okay.
So that's always my personal favorite in that genre.
Okay, I can see that. Well, I think when it comes to, for lack of a better term, space opera, I'm going to default to pretty much the default for pretty much anybody of a certain generation, of course, Star Wars. And just some of the elements and concepts of it. Of all the archetypes, the one I actually got the biggest kick out of is, well, droids. You know? I like the idea of, if you play one that's relatively sentient and so forth, you can have a lot of personality, whether it's, you know, for all the faults of C-3PO, you could say he definitely had a personality.
Oh, yeah.
R2, HK-77, K2SO, Chomper from the Rebels. You got all these characters with, you know, that are machines, but because they've been left on too long, they start developing their own personality. And it's not like, oh, no, they're all going to kill us. No, they're just quirky.
Exactly.
And very useful. In fact, that's probably one of my biggest beefs about the sequels is the Magic 8-Ball has no personality compared to any of the other droids that have come in through either, you know, the original trilogy, the cartoons, hell, even the Clone Wars for all their fault, even if they ended up recycling C-3PO and R2-D2. There's a reason they recycled them, even if they kind of played them a little silly. You know, and then you have, like, I loved Rogue One, and I liked K2's SO, because it was an interesting play on a droid that basically acts as an Imperial Protocol droid that's been redesigned, even if he was drawing heavily from somebody like Alan Rickman.
Yeah. No, you know, and that is an interesting choice. I mean, a lot of games I know that I've played, playing a robot sometimes isn't an option.
Yeah, that's true. You know?
But it is an interesting choice in games that do allow you to do that. Like, you know, obviously Savage Worlds, science fiction companion, that's an option. So therefore, obviously in, you know, the last Parsec setting that they have, it's an option to play, you know, a robot, which isn't bad, you know, because at least in Savage Worlds, at least the rules for, you know, what you're allowed to do kind of follows along, you know, because you're a robot, but you're an actual player character, you gain skills unlike the other robots, but
yeah,
you're kind of the exception. But even still, even the actual robots that are out there, I mean, even yourself, you're still limited what you can, like, attach to yourself or the upgrades you're allowed to have on yourself, which was something I think Savage Worlds did really well. Because other game systems, you know, you play and you're just like, well, if you have unlimited money, well, okay. All of a sudden, the robots just, you know, it kind of falls into that category of where it's kind of like cyber tech to me, you know, like, you know, in Cyberpunk, you know, you have cyberware, and it's like, at a certain point, it's like, it's just about money. How much more money can I spend to improve myself, you know, rather than, you know, obviously improving myself through, like, just experience.
Yeah, I can see that. Like, the biggest travesty that they did in a lot of these games is if you have a robot player character in your game, you should build them more or less the same way as everybody else to a lot of ways. Like, I have a copy of GURPS, and if I were to build a robot character in that game, I would use the standard point totals, not and try to make sure it's balanced within the base progress. Because somebody in their infinite wisdom decided back in third edition to try to build them the same way they build vehicles. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say on that one.
Yeah, see, no, that's no good.
Yeah.
But robots is a good choice. Now, when you get a little, you know, again, then, of course, let's go, I'm going to go to the superhero genre, because it is one of those ones where I have said many times that it's very hard to do a good superhero RPG. I don't care what anyone says.
Yeah. Well, the big trick is more than any other series, but that's one where you have to get together with your group and say, okay, what's our episode zero? What's our power baseline?
Right.
What are we going to get away with? What are we going to allow? Like, if everybody's playing X-Men and one person plays Superman, guess what? Why am I here?
Right. Well, and then you have to have a system where everyone's kind of on an equal footing. And I think that's where, you know, at a certain level, that's one thing that Champions had right originally, is that all the players were around the same point total, so their powers were going to be roughly the same. Now, the villains that you'd build would get more and more and more powerful because of the players would eventually get more powerful as the game progressed. You know, but, you know, because it's like, but it's always funny to watch. There was, and I'm sure there's archives of all this stuff, but, you know, people would, like, try to build Superman in Champions, and he'd be something ridiculous like 4,000 points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas in the when Champions first came out, the point total was 250 points was a standard character.
Yeah.
And I think by 5th edition, it was 350?
Yeah.
You know? So that's a big spread. I mean, but even the additional points, that was mostly just because there were more skills and some, you know, you had, basically, you just gained a few new powers.
Yeah.
But realistically, if you take the characters, they're roughly, even from, you know, there's less variance in the skills, but the power levels are still roughly about the same. You know, most attacks were roughly around 10d6 normal damage, you know, give or take, you know, which I guess to a certain feel is kind of why it gets boring, because you're like, well, most people have about this much move. You know, it's like, it's almost like they become templates. But still, within the superhero genre, there are accepted archetypal names.
I'd almost argue that not just the basic archetypes of superheroes, but you almost have to decide on what your theme is. Like, what are you going to try to use for a power set? Is it going to be a bunch of people running together? Like, I would argue, you know, playing off kind of on my space opera thing, Transformers is a superhero show. Because they're playing giant robots, and even a lot of them even had powers that were outside the robots in disguise concepts. Or you could play X-Men, where you're basically playing humans that you expect to basically have your back against the wall, and every so often you run into a mutant that's truly insanely powerful. But you probably shouldn't play those in the game, because otherwise you break the game. Like, you know, it's one thing playing Cyclops, but it's a thing entirely playing, say, Jean Grey. And there's a lot of different superhero genres, because a lot of people have played with the superhero concept. Like, you could argue that Rifts, in many ways, was a superhero campaign that just happened to replace metahuman powers with really cool guns and armor.
Yeah, I could see that.
You know, like, if you have mega damage, if you have a glitter boy, you rule the battlefield for the most part. You know, like, there's exceptions. There's always exceptions in games like that. But if you're playing a superheroes campaign, I guess the big question is, what are you going to play? And that becomes just as important to argue there. So with that in mind, I've already given away what my two favorite concepts are.
But go ahead and say them.
Transformers and X-Men for the basic concepts for superheroes. And as for actual archetypes, I've gotten a lot of mileage out of bricks, aka super strong characters, and just seeing how they play off each other. Like, I love improvised combat, and the brick is the ultimate improviser of combat. Right. Like, you think of Ben Grimm, and he gift wraps people by literally bending things around their opponents without actually hurting them. Or you can, like, the patented Juggernaut Punch. Or the Superman Speed Blitz. You know, it's such a simple power, but it's also a power you kind of really want in real life, because is annoying, you know, who hasn't had that big, heavy object you got to move from one room to the next, and you really don't want to do it?
No, I can see that.
You know? Whereas you could argue that more esoteric powers, you know, like, the one that actually makes the least amount of sense, like, if you think of it, what powers would you want in real world? I find the blaster concept to actually be the one that almost feels like you kind of lost the lottery, you know? No matter how good a shot you are and amazingly you are in combat, unless you find a specific use for it outside of it. You know, it's the one you might get the least amount of mileage. Like, I don't know. What is your favorite genre and archetype, I guess?
For the superhero?
Yes.
You know, I would have to say definitely, you know, I think it's just my tech nature, especially in superheroes. I've always liked the gadgeteer types.
Oh, yeah. I can agree with that.
Or, oddly, the magician type.
Oh, absolutely, man. You know, like,
but, and in some ways, those are one and the same.
Well, the only difference is your power source, ultimately, right. Because you're basically, either way, you're pulling a rabbit out of your hat in a situation where you need something essential. Like,
well, I think, especially in superheroes, I like always playing the utility character. Mm-hmm. You know, because there's always, like you said, there's always someone who's going to be a brick or a speedster or something. And it's like, you know, I'm always a big fan of having the weird utility powers.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Because you get, I've always felt you get more mileage out of them, you know.
Well, the trick is, if you're playing a real gadgeteer type, whether it's technologically or magically based, you always have an answer. It might not always be a great answer, but you always have an answer. And if you're combining it with the synergy of your fellow party members, like, you give the speedster 3 rolls of duct tape, go nuts. And, you know, suddenly 3 people are bound without having to have any issues. And also, you can kind of draw on your real-world knowledge and kind of say, would this work or not, or even if it's just from a narrative perspective. Like, there's a reason why, even in games where you have a lot of powers, everybody kind of gravitates towards the grappling hook. You know, when it comes to stuff like that. Like, let's be honest, we all, to some degree, like Batman. And he is the ultimate polymath. You know, there's people that are better in his single skills in order to do so. There are better martial artists, there are better gadgeteers, there are better things here. But when you're top 3 across the board, you can always change your response. You can't outfight him, you outgadget him. If you can't outgadget him or outfight him, you outstealth him. Or you outdetect him, you know? Having an answer always makes you feel good. Now, the problem with that is you might end up kind of being written in a corner. Like, you know, there's the old age-old question in the Justice League, what does Batman do? And the question is either nothing or everything.
I guess that's true.
You know, either he's the single greatest character on the planet because of all his skill sets, or in a party that's dominated by Superman, Wonder Woman, and Martian Manhunter, why are you here again?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of one of those weird things, and that's also why, if you do run a Supers campaign, make sure everybody is at least, if not of a similar power level. Like, if you're all playing Kryptonians and you're exploring the cosmos, that's awesome. Even if you have slightly different powers because of it, you know? Or if you're playing like a, if you combine it with Space Opera and play a Guardians of the Galaxy campaign, and then just sort of reskin a lot of the superpowers as aliens, you could have a lot of mileage out of that. Especially when you're combining different genres and mixing them together. Like, when you're playing your brick archetype, you're an alien from another planet, or you're genetically engineered, you know, thing here. Or you're a heavy earther, or something to that effect.
Right.
So, I guess that's part of the fun, is just deciding what you want to do with it in the first place. And for the gadgeteer, well, that sounds like you can play it very street level, or you can play cosmic. Like, you could argue that this, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, like I said, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of different mileage, there's a lot of takes on any of these archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
The thing I will say is, definitely in a superhero campaign, I think for people who aren't very familiar, or maybe not familiar with the game system in general that's being used,
Definitely
the brick is probably one of the more straightforward, I won't say easiest, but more straightforward to play. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, let's face it, you know, there's a reason that people just, you know, jokingly say Hulk smash, you know. That's fairly easy.
Well, you know, he stole the show in the Avengers, which was a hard show to steal, when he decided to put out Loki.
Right.
And, you know, ragdolled him. And then in Thor 3, there was a callback to that scene where Loki literally stood up in the middle of a, you know, and said, "Now you know how it feels," to his brother, which keeps the joke going, you know. And also, it's the same thing, like, why. Well, it's the old human psyche thing. Range weapons technically are better in every conceivable way in the real world, but hand-to-hand is a lot more fun to watch if you do it right.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of those interesting things about gaming in general. I mean, if you ever look at games, the ranges that things actually happen at in a game setting are always pretty close.
Yeah.
You know, you... And I think that's just because that's how we want the action. We want the fisticuffs. We want the swashbuckling action, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We want the fancy sword fights. Because at a certain level, range combat is boring.
well, it's a lot of waiting around and a lot of tense moments, but you're, you know, if it's based on a single die roll, it's over. Whereas the other one, you might be able to do some other things. Like, you might be able to pull off some really cool 80s feels for the game. But if you play modern combat properly, it's a lot of boredom, followed by a lot of really manic moments where you're basically in a life or death situation here.
Exactly.
And, well, that's part of the fun. Okay.
All right, so what else should we cover?
Well, let's go for historical. Is there not so much a character archetype, but is there a particular history time period that would be really fun to play that you think is one of the better ones?
I think the one that I've always been the most interested in playing, but never really have, is the Roman era.
Took the words right out of my mouth, actually. Well
done. That's crazy that we, you know, if you take the Roman and the Egyptian kind of together in that one, especially primarily Roman, but you know, you have the Egyptians, you have the Greeks, whatever. It's a fascinating time. From just that standpoint. And, you know, depending on how historically accurate you want to be or not, it's like there's a lot of political intrigue possibilities. There's a lot of just, you know, there's a whole... I think the fantasy of Rome, if you will, is what draws you in. You know, it's like, you know, there's gladiatorial combat. No matter what you think of that, there's, you know, that's something that, that happened, and it's fascinating, it's exciting, you know, you can have, you know, this possibility of having a character that's an ex-gladiator, or is a gladiator, or the characters get involved and are forced to become gladiators for a period of time.
Yeah, there's enough exoticism that you can try different character concepts and archetypes.
Right.
But there's a unifying tissue that's there, like... A while back, we talked about the concept of Greek punk, a.k.a. happening during the Second Peloponnesian Wars, where you combine the Greek, the Roman, the ancient world. Well, they still have a lot of connections, but before it becomes essentially a single block, you know. And I stand by that one of these days, once I get through a whole bunch of other stuff, I'm going to sit down and try to, hammer out a concept. Especially when I found out that one historical figure kind of fits a concept that kicked around a long time ago. A suitable replacement for Ivan the Terrible, where after he dies, it kind of weakened the whole thing base. Like, there's a Roman character by the name of Sulla you may have heard of or not. He essentially ran a period of terror about 30, you know, a generation before the Republic fell. He thought he put everything back together, but because of his actions... It weakened the Republic and caused the rise of first Julius Caesar, and then, of course, the great fights between Mark Antony and Augustus. And just because there's enough material to hang your hat on, but there's a lot of gaps in the knowledge, you can go nuts. And then you throw in something like magic or weird technology and so forth, and it becomes its own beast. And you still have commerce, you still have the basic concepts there. And you still got people that know enough of each other that they can... It's cosmopolitan enough of a setting that you can mix the different things together. Like, but it's still enough common territory that if you play it right, you can have a lot of fun. Yeah. Like, you can throw in a Lovecraft aspect if you really want to, because a lot of the Lovecraft, you know, mystery cults, we don't know, still don't know what the hell they did. And do we really want to know? I guess in this world, yes.
Yeah, you know, and I think that, you know, I think that's part of what's fascinating, you know, that whole, all that weird stuff, because, I mean, the Romans borrowed a lot, and there were a lot of weird little religious cults.
Yeah, and it seems like whenever they start building a really big empire of some way, shape, or form in a fantasy environment, they often always crib from Rome in some way, shape, or form, because that's their basis for getting the knowledge together.
And, I mean, let's face it, if it's not Roman, the other one, of course, is the Egyptians that people try to crib a lot from.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I always think that it's funny as heck that one of the reasons why Egyptians were so mythicized, we had all these, you know, hieroglyphics during the Middle Ages, that we didn't know what the hell they said, so they made up their own magical or spiritual connotations. when they finally got access to the Rosetta Stone, a lot of these just became essentially shopping lists.
Well, if nothing else, I mean, they were great bureaucrats. They actually had a lot of accounting.
Oh, yes. Like, it's amazing, some of their stuff there. Like, just some of their medicine was considered one of the most advanced in the thing there, the use of cotton. And the fact that we're still, even in 2018, we're closer to the end of the Egyptian Empire, to the, you know, the death of Cleopatra, than Cleopatra's death is to the beginning of Egypt. And it's over 2,000 years later. That's kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. That culture had a long, long history.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, well, they consider the Eternal Kingdom, you know, between the, you know, two Egyptian, you know, the two different territories, North and South Egypt, and all the different things there, the use of host gods, the weird papyrus scrolls, the fact that they built bloody stone pyramids long before a lot of us even knew they existed. You know, it's... And, of course, the idea of using magic, which is basically they were considered the Near East and were the basis for a lot of stuff that, you know, modern mysticism took what they wanted and they left the rest. You know, when they went through the mysticism age of the 19th century, a lot of them were based on taking a little bit from Egypt, a little from Tibet, a little from China, mixing it together in a package. And, you know, you go to the underworld, you have your heart, the situation here, or... And it's also Egypt's a gift that keeps on giving because you keep getting archetypes pulling in after they exist. You always have an ancient empire of some sort. And because mummies were so bloody numerous, it's not that hard to pop one up later like we did in our classic Hollywood movie monsters.
Oh, yeah.
Episode. So, in short, Egypt has a lot of stuff, and I'd argue that just like Vikings and Nordic, you know, Norsemen, they're kind of the most common exotic realm outside of standard medieval or medieval Renaissance, depending on which version of fantasy you like.
Right.
Okay. But, okay, let's go for another one.
All right,
pulp.
One more pulp.
Okay.
Ooh, that covers a large era.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, it covers a large topic, but definitely
important. Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to say, especially for, the, you know, depending on when you consider the pulp era.
Yeah.
A lot of times I prefer the ex-soldiers.
Yeah.
Or, but it depends. Probably one of my favorite characters that I ever played, and I don't know if this is, you know, we're talking pulp in, say, the 1930s.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, 20s, 30s usually is typical, the interwar period.
Yeah. Which is why the soldier is always interesting, because it's like you have some guys that they fought in World War One and they're around. But I say probably, and I mean, a lot of my pulp era stuff is very Lovecraftian. I've done a lot of Call of Cthulhu in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
So probably my two favorite from that era, A, like I said, has always been like the soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of, you know, wannabe librarians or bureaucrats of some sort.
But yeah.
My personal favorite, oddly, is like the weird hobo character. / Drifter.
Well, that's definitely an archetype.
Yeah.
You know, you have the guy that sort of wanders into town and does something good or bad.
Well, you know, basically a character that people normally maybe look down upon.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, you know, these, you know, someone who maybe is not from the best of society, and for whatever reason, it's like, I just happen to know stuff.
Yeah. Basically, hobo, never-do-well, drifter, whatever. But you still got those skills that are probably not common, but very useful to survive. No, it makes perfect sense.
You know. I mean, anyone can be the standard two-fisted action hero.
Yeah, that's true. But I ain't gonna lie to you. I already know who my favorite archetype is, and I blame the 80s for that.
And that is?
The rough and tumble archaeologist.
Yeah. No, I mean, obviously, Indiana Jones, let's face it, has had a deep impact on our psyche.
Mm-hmm.
And I just saw something somewhere where they're already talking about they're actually going to film a fifth movie.
I love the movies, but there's only three movies, and well, I can't say too much because unfortunately I wasn't there, but part of me knows there was like a 5-year delay between the third and the fourth movie, that if it had happened 5 years sooner, a lot of things would have made a lot more sense. Like Marcus Brody would have still, the actor would have still been alive. And then some of those scenes would have made a lot more sense just having somebody show up. Like, he was meant to play a very prominent role, and you can see it in the movies, the fourth one. Also, the fact that there's only so much you can do with, well, again, the original trilogy really played well with the practical effects and models and so forth. Like, everything from Raiders, Temple of Doom, and Last Crusade all had their set pieces where, okay, we're in a really screwed situation. How do we get out there? And I would argue the true spiritual successor was the 90s movie The Mummy, where they played a lot of the same themes, but they actually tried to break it up into a party.
Right.
You know?
No, I could see that. Actually, you know, that particular remake of The Mummy was probably my personal favorite out of any of the remakes I've seen in a while. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The sequel wasn't that exciting, but...
Well, yeah, it's basically its defining thing. It was fun to watch, but you could definitely tell they were starting to get heavily into CGI. Like, you could tell it's the beginning of the age of CGI.
Right.
And you can see the transformation of the characters' types there. But you can play film noir, you can play Lovecraftian, you can play... basically, if you want a really interesting environment that hasn't been played too much, be involved in the Spanish Civil War. You know, play that as the backdrop of your thing. Maybe you're one of those people that went over there with bright eyes that joined the socialists. Or maybe you're one of the ones that helped Franco come to power. And suddenly you have a little microcosm of things to come.
Yeah.
And you throw out some other estimates, or you can have the weird science aspect, because, again, this is, I've said it once, I'll say it again, this was the era where you had enough technology to get in trouble and not enough to get out.
You know, I was just thinking, another weird era that I don't think has been covered a lot is that era of when what we think of the Old West was ending and the more technologically advanced age was beginning.
Yeah. You mean like the New West era, like the 1900s to like 1920? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because a couple of movies really come to mind when I think of that. One, of course, is... You know, The Shootist with John Wayne.
Yeah.
And, well, hell, another one with John Wayne in it, Big Jake, was kind of that way.
Oh, yeah, I remember Big Jake. That was actually a really amazing one, especially when the car shows up.
You know. And, I mean, you can also, if you want to go the more fantastical, even pulpy, you can always include, like, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. in that era, kind of.
Absolutely. Like, you could definitely tell that they were heavily influenced with the concept. Like, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. were steampunk before we knew that was a term.
Right.
Even though they were using more electrical stuff and things here. But you could definitely tell it was the generation after the Old West.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's like, I always think of one thing. Especially, I mean, there is one thing. I remember watching a documentary, and they were talking about what they consider the last actual gunfight of the Old West. And do you know who was involved?
No. Who was?
Patton.
That actually makes a lot of sense, knowing Patton.
They were hunting like Mexican bandits. You know, and they were still, you know, driving, you know, they were using obviously automobiles, you know, vehicles, and it's one of the reasons that he carried revolvers. You know, there was a weird reason that he liked to carry revolvers, because of, you know, this time in the Old West hunting Mexican bandits.
And I can see that.
And I forget the exact situation, but I remember, you know, he was actually involved, and a lot of people consider that the last official gunfight of what they consider the Old West before the more modern era.
Yeah, if I had to say the most interesting historical event from that era, it's got to be when the U.S. Army invaded Mexico to go get Pancho Villa. You know, it was during World War One. It was one of the effects there. And I don't know, it'd be such a different campaign if you did it, depending on which side you want to play.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
All right, well, why don't we get into the Kickstarters and close out this show? What do you think?
That sounds good to me.
So, speaking of steampunk, well, there's something called dieselpunk.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I think, is kind of a weird one. It says 19 days ago. It's asking for $5,000. It has about $3,500. That's U.S. dollars. It's called Fuel Priest, the dieselpunk tabletop RPG. It's basically kind of like weird fighter combat, but the players are pilots that are priests and there's some sort of how do they describe it? Where is it here? Like divine energy that powers their planes.
Okay.
And I'm like, well, that's unique. I don't know if I could play that, but that's unique.
Yeah, and I gotta admit, that's something that's fun, but I'm curious because, well, you can tell what they're trying to draw on. Obviously, they're trying to draw on the era of World War II, the flying planes, you know, the Battle of Britain.
Right.
Invasions and so forth. Or the Pacific, which was dominated by aircraft. And trying to make it into their own little universe. So, I don't know if you can really play that as a... I'd be curious to see how they play it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like very much a pulp thing. And I guess this would cover that era. Or at least the tail end of that era.
Exactly.
You're talking about before.
So I just think that's interesting. You know, that's kind of a weird one.
Well, give them full points for originality.
Yeah. But the funny thing is, it's not the only airplane-related Kickstarter we have. There's and they've reached their goal, by the way. There's the Flying Circus, a role-playing game of high-flying adventure. It's clearly from the artwork set in World War One.
Yeah.
So, it's like, wow. Well, again. You know, and I think, unfortunately, the dawn of military aircraft is one of those things that, even today, just fires the imagination from the standpoint of, they did what with nothing?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally, when you think about it, you know, aircraft hadn't been around that long.
No.
You know, we were originally using, especially during World War One, initially aircraft was like, obviously, they were scout vessels, and some idiot, you know, pulled out a revolver and shot at the other scout. And the next thing you know, it progresses from there where people are mounting machine guns and then shooting each other down. And then, you know, even, you know, trying to drop bombs from just throwing them over the side, dropping bombs on troops and all that other stuff.
Yeah. Well, again, it always blows my mind that there actually were Zeppelin attacks during World War One. You know, the idea of just sort of, because they were able to fly higher than everything else, they basically tried to drop and hope for the best. Didn't work very well. But it was also, there were many weapons that got introduced in World War One that were actually banned 20 years before. And one of them were Zeppelins as combat personnel, because they were afraid it would change the nature of warfare. And they were absolutely right. And then you go into the airplanes, which, I don't know about you, but I'm a sucker for a good fight between a Fokker and a Suffolk Camera. Even though it really didn't do a lot as far as World War One is concerned, because they couldn't move the line worth a darn, especially on the Western Front.
You know, speaking of that, what the hell was, hold on. Oh, come on. What was it called? I'm sorry. All of a sudden, there it is. This is the one that I always remember. It's a weird movie from 1986.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's Biggles, Adventures in Time. It's a 1986 movie.
I've heard the name, and
I think I've mentioned it on the show before. And the whole premise is some guy from, obviously, 1986 gets transported back to World War One, and meets some guy, you know, this obviously this this British fighter pilot, Bigglesworth, and their job eventually is to stop the German super weapon that they have. The Germans have developed some sort of sound weapon that they've been using.
I now want to hunt down this movie. Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, no worries.
Man, I always love a little bit of the crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, IMDb gives it like 5.8 stars. I think it's just kitschy enough to enjoy even later. Because what reminded me of that was, you know, the whole stop with Camel thing, where you know, the main character at a later point in the movie is flying a helicopter, and he says, "If you can fly a swipe with a Camel, you can fly anything."
Yeah,
you know, it's like, okay, there. Yeah, I think it's actually based on a book, believe it or not.
Yeah, I think there was a series of children's books involving that character. I remember somewhere in the back of my head. Don't remember too much more beyond that, but now I'm officially intrigued. I might hunt it down just to see what I can find out.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Cushing is in it, for Christ's sakes.
Oh, man.
You know? I mean, he doesn't play a major part. He's a guest part, but geez.
Well, again, anything between the 60s and 80s that involves either Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee, I'm always intrigued just at least once.
Yeah.
Even if it's bad. You know, even if it's bad, they're not going to be, if that makes any sense.
I'm actually curious now. You know, Rotten Tomatoes is always a better judge sometimes of ratings, what people think on something, than IMDb. I know that sounds weird. I wonder if this shows up in there. I'm sure it does. Let's just see. Folks, this is just for my curiosity alone. Yes, there we go. They listed as 1988. Oh, and only 40% of the audience liked it. Okay, so it's a crapshoot. I think for what it is, it's a silly movie, and you just have to go into with that concept. It's not supposed to be a serious movie, I don't think.
Well, again, if the movie is memorable, even if it's silly or bad in some way, it's a hell of a lot better than a movie that's boring. And, you know, that's one of some of the best movies that MST3K did a, you know, comedy sketch on. Have always been the ones that are fun but flawed. And this sounds like one of those, so yeah. It's definitely on the shoot list.
So anyway, so there is this Flying Circus game, so there you go.
Yeah.
What was that?
Oh, you know somebody's going to build somebody by the name of Monty.
Yeah. So let's see. That's not too bad. $11 for the PDF.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'd be fun. The copy is about $23 US. That's not bad.
Yep.
Not still interesting game. I don't have room for it in my collection right now. Sorry.
No, well, they made their money, so it's nothing to be ashamed of as far as that's concerned. I think it'd be a fun play, but you'd really have to sell this on your party. Like, the biggest problem I see is the best thing about the game, you would almost have to build a party of, well, you'd have to play a wing.
That's probably, you know, the assumption in the game system.
Yeah. And if that's part of the fun, like, you'd have to play essentially a group of planes, not like you'd play an adventuring party, so that everybody would have to do something, you know.
Well,
and that way you could just.
I think that's a whole another interesting thing. It's like, and actually, you know what? We should stick that as a topic. I'm gonna add it in here. Role playing. Because,
sounds,
you know,
good.
Because definitely in those military groups, you're all the characters are very similar, because it's like, yeah, we're all in the Navy.
Yeah.
We're all in the Army. There's certain skills. And I mean, I have some experience with this with like Tour of Darkness. You know,
yeah.
You have to, your characters are at a certain level very similar, but you have to do something to differentiate yourself, even if it's just your background. But we can talk about that in a full episode.
Oh, absolutely. I think I'll put a pin in it, because I'm already thinking of two different popular movies I could easily crib from.
Right.
And we'll save them for next time.
Yeah. And one of them's a military movie that's not a military movie.
Mm-hmm.
Are you thinking of the one I'm thinking of?
Well, let's just say it involves a dozen.
No, I wasn't thinking of that one. I was thinking more of along the lines of Tropic Thunder.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
I mean, that. But we can talk about that, obviously, on that episode. So, okay, so let's go to the next Kickstarter. Next up, we have From Beyond, Descent, Science Fiction RPG, Starfinder Adventure. I've never played the Starfinder system, have you?
I haven't had the fortune yet, no.
So,
but I had a buddy write about the book, but I've thumbed through and that's about it.
Yeah, apparently this is the second of six Starfinder RPG-compatible adventures. So, if you happen to play Starfinder, this might... They were not asking a lot of money. They were asking for... I think the conversion to USD was 267. They've already reached it at 329.
So, good for them. And again, I like...
MX, is that Mexican dollars?
I think it is MX.
Yeah.
So it looks kind of neat. Like, I'll give them credit. I like... You can tell they're on a budget, but I like their form factor.
Yeah.
I like the way it looks. It kind of gives me that 80s sci-fi feel to the adventure, you know? Where before, well, you saw the vector graphics feel for the landing points, the kind of feeling of the, like, I won't lie to you, this intrigues me. If I played Starfinder for realsies, I would probably pick this up in a heartbeat, just on the sheer form factor. Mind you, I don't know the game that well, and if anybody wants to tell us all about it, go right ahead.
Wow, yeah, I mean... So, I mean, that's not too bad. I mean, adventure plus the stretch goals. So, yeah, I mean, they're not asking a hell of a lot of money.
Nope.
So, that's pretty impressive. And you can, I mean, they have a simple backer one for if you're looking to get the first part, you know, because it's the second part. So they have the first part. You can get the first. That's always important, I think, with a Kickstarter is to, if you have something that's a series of adventures, always have an option to either as an add-on or some other way to get the first episode.
Yeah, that's true.
Or whatever, how many you've already published.
Because
if you're doing, you know, if you're finally publishing set six out of six, you need to have the people's ability to get one through five as well as six.
Preach in the choir there, man, because I almost think that you almost have to, well, you probably do it in sections just to see if there's a market, but it feels to me like, yeah, I almost want to pick it up all at once, you know, if I get really interested in it, but I could also understand picking up the first part just to see what it's like, you know, testing the waters. But it looks fun. They converted over the Hobgoblin and the Durgar into space, which space Hobgoblins, I think that's Klingons. That's a good thing. And, well, we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. All right. So this is one that I think is a little weird, but some people might like. Imp of the Perverse, a Jacksonian Gothic American horror RPG. And the description of this is, hunt down monsters in order to save yourself in this RPG inspired by the work of Edgar Allan Poe. Can you resist your imp's temptation?
Okay, that could be... Well, I'll give him points for originality yet again. So basically what's happening is you're basically... It's basically Morality Tale, the RPG.
Okay, so here's what you do. In this darker... Here's the full description. In this darker version of the 1830s and 1840s, you play a member of society with an imp of perversion on your shoulder, constantly impelling you to do terrible deeds. Only by hunting down those who have given into their imps and turned into monsters themselves can you rid yourself of yours. As you hunt, your imp grows in power, tempting with more and more rewards that await beyond the shroud.
Okay, that sounds pretty kind of awesome.
Again, I like the idea of this one, but you definitely have to have the right group for something like this. I don't think... Absolutely. I mean, they've reached their goal. They're only asking for $5,000. They're at over 11,000 right now. So $13 gets you the PDF, which is not bad.
No, absolutely.
$28 gets you the book. And I guess there's some cards? some quick play cards you can get for like $38 and get the book and the quick play cards.
Yeah. No, that sounds fun. And I'm just looking at the stuff here. I got a friend of mine who's really diehard Edgar Allan Poe fan as of late, so let's just say it might be a future gift of some sort.
All right, there you go. All right. So let's get into a couple of 5th edition things.
Okay.
First up, we have a 5th edition adventure, The Shadow Over Dunsmore Point. It's a 5th edition adventure for 4 to 6 first level characters. They've already reached their goal.
Yay.
What was that?
Yay.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I'm always a big fan of adventures, you know. Right now, you can get the PDF, which is what I always recommend, for about $10. Mm-hmm. U.S. That's not bad. I think that's the way it should be, you know. I think in this day and age, and I know some people just argue with me, it's like adventures to me, unless there's something special, really special about them, I don't really like buying them in print anymore.
Yeah.
A PDF makes much more sense for me.
But I ain't gonna lie to you, the draft map of the region really is giving me a first edition flashback in a good way. Like, it feels like one of those old school D&D maps, you know, pre-grid, you know, kind of between, before you put a grid on it or something.
You know, it's funny, though, is I can kind of say that I would not be surprised if this was built with Campaign Cartographer.
I could see that.
There are bits and pieces of it that kind of remind me of some sort of Campaign Cartographer touch. But it's a draft map. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with Campaign Cartographer, by the way. It's just, it's a lot of stuff for the most basic map drawing, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I got a friend of mine who plays with it a lot. Heck, he helped write some of our products using it, so I'm not going to diss Campaign Cartographer and any stuff that way. But he definitely swears like a sailor when he does it sometimes.
It's funny because I wish there were some more of the professional cartographer tools available that most people could use.
Yeah.
They're just too expensive. It's like my personal favorite, and I mean, this is not more cartography, this is more cartographical data. I used to use ArcEdit, ArcGIS.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was like, wow, you know, making a map in this fucking makes sense. Because then I can scale the map to what I need to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, you can do things, you can associate data with it, you know. I mean, I could create a layer and go like, here's where the realms go. You know, this is where the creatures are. This is where this type of terrain, you know, and you could do intersects and like all of a sudden go like, yeah, there should be, you know, hey, you know, maybe I have desert wandering goblins. Why the hell is that? You know, but you get the idea. You know, you can do things in there that you couldn't do anywhere else. And I don't know. That's just me.
No, well, a map is worth every penny, but the problem, you know, the trick is making sure you have the right skill set. Like, if I had the skills, I probably would have taken quite a few cartography courses just because, well, I like maps. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And, you know, the truth is that maps are semi-artwork. I will always admit that. The problem I get with some maps, and I think I've said this a lot, is that they become more artwork than informational.
Yeah,
and that's a problem. It's one thing to have a map that's a piece of artwork, but it's always maps are meant to convey information. If it's not giving you the information you're wanting or needing, then it has failed as a map. And I have seen many a maps. Paizo is a classic example. They have some great looking maps, but at the end of the day, you look at their maps, and sometimes I can't discern what the terrain really is.
Yeah.
Whereas if I actually had an old school first edition AD&D map that was just blue on white, they would have drawn some lines to explain to me what the terrain really looked like.
Yeah.
They might have even given me a cutaway section that explained it.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Like, don't get me wrong, I have fond, very, very fond memories of the old cloth maps from at the risk of dating myself, Ultima 4 and 5, which I still own and am very proud to own. But you're definitely right. Like, I think we're at the point where if you're going to make a map, it should be like, well, let's just say we're a reason we like Hask maps around here, because you know exactly what the terrain is.
Yeah. All right, next up we have the 5th edition player starter kit. And
okay.
It basically, the way they describe it, is it will contain 12 pre-made characters, 12 pre-made level 4 5th edition characters, one of every class. You know, it's an interesting idea, but I think as a Dungeon Master, you could do these yourself.
Yeah, this is one. If I were to do something like this, I'd almost include a first level adventure with it as well. Just so that you have... Oh, again, I always think of both how Pathfinder and 4th edition D&D built these beginner boxes. You know, like, you got to set up a gateway drug in order to sell this stuff. And that was my original thought, what they were trying to build, but it looks like it's just first level characters.
Well, these are 4th level
characters.
Sorry,
pre-made 4th level characters, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and, honestly, my favorite thing in the old D&D days was crap, what the hell was it? The Rogues Gallery? Yeah. That's what it's called, right?
The Rogues Gallery?
Yeah.
Or...
That's what it was called, right? D&D. It was their...
That was back in first edition, right?
Yeah. Was it the Rogues Gallery? Rogues Gallery. Yeah,
well,
the Rogues Gallery. I am right. 48 pages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it. It had a whole bunch of pre-made characters. Of course, it was mostly just stat blocks back then.
Yeah.
You know, so basically, it was a table with a whole bunch of stat blocks for all different classes, you know, levels of things. And the best part was the back, which actually had some of the characters that actually were used by Gary Gygax's original D&D campaign.
Yeah.
Which is where you were introduced to a person who got reincarnated as a lizard man. You know.
That must have been like one of the first examples of that.
And it was weird because it was fun to watch because it was fun to read because, you know, you had all these characters that they may have been ninth level, but they only had like maybe +1/+2 weapons max. And you're just like, huh. And you always wondered, if you know, because a lot of us played obviously heavy Monty Hall style campaigns where, you know, by ninth level, you probably had a +4 weapon.
Yeah.
You know.
And again, if you're, by the time you got to ninth level, you must have been playing pretty much nonstop since D&D began, because leveling was sure as heck a lot slower.
Yeah. All right. So next we have up Siren's Call, Interstellar Colonization Roleplaying, a campaign in Interstellar Colonization source books for the Shadows Over Seoul role-playing game. I've never heard of Shadows Over Seoul. Have you?
I'm afraid I have no knowledge of this thing.
Yeah, it's weird because they met their goal. I mean, they still got 23 days to go, and they reached their goal by like fourfold. So it's weird how, you know, that's the funny thing about these Kickstarters. You come up and like, there's supplements for games I've never heard of. So I'd love it to know if any of our listeners have actually heard of Shadows Over Seoul. Good news is that I do like again, they give you a pledge level where you can get the hardback copy of the adventure and the hardback copy of the game. That's important. Can you get it? Or you can just get it if you want to just get them both in PDF format. It's like $30.
Okay.
So, but that's good. That's the way it should be. And they've already reached their goal. They've unlocked 3 stretch goals. I kind of have a love-hate relationship with stretch goals.
Yeah, I'm nothing.
I mean, sometimes it's like, I get it. They're like, well, we got these kind of cool things. But I think sometimes you can overdo it with stretch goals.
Yeah.
Just my opinion.
Yeah, and they mentioned what this was giving me vibes to, and that's actually a good thing to draw from. Sid Meier's Alpha Centauri. I played that in the original Civ to Death back in the day. So it's kind of fun just drawing on that zeitgeist. Not sure how they do it, but now I'm kind of curious, so we'll see. I'll put that on. It's a definite maybe. Just, you know, it is. When you see something that's you like enough that you're curious, but you're not sure if you want to spend the money yet, so you add it to the list and see if you forget about it or not.
Yeah. No. So, okay. So next up we have Emissary Lost, epic campaign for the award-winning, I never could pronounce this. Is it Coloris? Coloris RPG?
Coriolis.
What was it?
Coriolis.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Coriolis is what I'm going to go with. If we're spelling a whole song, you can let us know.
Yeah, they've definitely reached their goal. They were asking just a little over $6,000 US, and they're over $80,000 US right now.
Yeah.
So that's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the PDF is roughly going to be about $24 US, which isn't too bad. And then about $42 for the print copy.
Yeah.
I know I've heard of the RPG before. I've just never played it.
Yeah. Okay. I love the map. I think it looks awesome. But I'm getting flashbacks, and I don't know why. I've seen it before. I just don't know where, and I have never seen this game before. Or maybe it's just your typical blobby map. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's all it is.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So here's a Savage World one for you. The Dinosaur Protocol for Savage Worlds.
I like dinosaurs.
Well, it's listed as a post-apocalyptic tabletop RPG of adventure and discoveries in the jungles and plains of a world grown wild and strange. So basically, there are dinosaurs because, well, they're mutants.
I could sum this up with three words. Cadillacs and dinosaurs.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it has this cool, you know, drawing of some guy riding a dinosaur.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue there. So basically, it's dinosaur post-apocalyptic. I ain't going to lie to you. It's been added to the Ook list. Whether or not I actually purchase it remains to be seen, but
it's $10 for the PDF. That's not too bad.
Yeah.
They still got a little ways to go. Like, you know, they're asking roughly almost $2,900 and they're at a little over $1,700.
I ain't gonna lie to you. I'd be willing to give it a shot. We'll see what happens. Well, let's be honest. Dinosaurs are fun. Dinosaurs in a post-apocalyptic world where you have to go hunt, scavenge, and other stuff here. That's fun. Although I probably end up riding a more likely a hadrosaur or grabbing a sauropod as a weapon of war of some sort. Like, it depends how dinosaurs are played, whether or not they actually play them as, you know, unstoppable killing machines or if they're basically used like horses. I don't know. But, like, we'll see.
Yep. All right, so let's bring up the other Savage World entry. Savage, I don't even know how to pronounce it. I'm a horrible.
Savage. All I know is I see the word kaiju.
Yep.
So therefore, I'm going to assume. Okay, so basically. Sorry, I'm just reading here. So basically, if you ever wanted to play rubber suits in Savage Worlds from like Japanese science fiction,
right. This
is your game. You could probably play G-Force as well. Well, it also looks. Yeah, that's what this is reminding me of is Gatchaman.
Yeah. You know, or something along the lines of that, or, you know.
Armin Rider, or
there's so many. I mean, if you want to take the American imports of things like Power Rangers, you can kind of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I intrigued, but don't know if I want to put my money where my mouth is. I'll give you full kudos this day, Dev. You brought a lot of original games to the table today.
Oh well, I love these things. That's why that's why I do the Kickstarters, because you're like. To me, this is the interesting stuff. Even if I'm never going to buy it, it's like, well, that's interesting. At least that's something good and unique.
I will always give points for originality, even if it's not always well fleshed out, because at least you're trying something new.
Yeah. All right, so next up we have Agents of ARF, A-A-R-F, Volume 1, a Pathfinder 5th Edition compatible adventure path. And it is described as Agents of ARF is a 5th Edition Pathfinder compatible adventure path set on the continent of Lena, a land of 7 competing realms inhabited by hybrids, races fused from a genetic mixture of animals and humans.
Wow. Okay, somebody's obviously having a lot of fun with this concept, otherwise you wouldn't call your game ARF.
Yeah.
It's anthro-fantasy in the realm of Redwald, Miss Vandals, and Mouseguard.
Yeah.
So, basically, the races are based on different eras within the continent itself. Like, felines have an Egyptian motif, canines are medieval European, ruminants are 17th century France and Manasi, Japan. The rodents are 19th century London speed bugs. It sounds like they threw everything in a pot and just saw what came out.
Yep, pretty much.
I guess it'd be fun. I'll give them credit. Like, their art, as cartoony as their art is, I have to give them credit for originality.
Nothing like a bunny with a hammer.
And I'm getting another case of deja vu when it comes to their maps. Maybe there are only so many landmasses you can do before you have to make them your own.
Well, I mean, it's just, I think what happens is once you do maps at a certain level, I think all maps look the same. I know it sounds horrible, but they do.
Well, they look like a splat, and then you just sort of shape it to try to make it look its own color.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, right. I mean, clearly, you know, I mean, plus there's certain, you want to make it look at least semi-realistic, so you end up following certain rules of natural progression. Like, you know, obviously the mountains follow the coastline, even since it has a semicircle of a coastline, so obviously the mountains kind of follow the semicircle around.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way that is.
Okay. That's probably it, you know. Because you can practically see, you know, the inland seas look familiar. But I guess that kind of makes sense because, you know, Australia, when they originally found it, they thought there was a big sea in the middle of it. That it was a desert, so maybe I'm drawing on that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, here nor there.
Actually, you know what my favorite feature of Australia is? There's outcroppings in the middle of the desert. Instead of normal, you know, we have obviously rock striations.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of being, you know, obviously horizontal, they're vertical.
Okay. Weird.
And the reason for that is some seismic event actually shoved the rock crust up and caused them to become vertical. And it's weird because they're in a line of sorts. So it's like every so many miles, there's another one of these things.
Okay, that's weird because that reminds me almost of folded mountains, kind of like the ones we have in the Rockies.
Yeah.
So, but smaller, so it's kind of weird.
Yeah. They're all, I mean, most of the Aboriginal cultures, you know, in Australia consider them sacred.
Oh, for good reason.
Yeah. So there's your tidbit for today for, you know, cartographical information. And on a more, for a linguistical note, in Australia, my understanding, limited as it is that the actual Aboriginal language of Australia, their traditional counting is one, two, few, many.
Nice.
Because, you know, anything over a few, you really don't care. There's just a bunch of them.
Yeah.
It doesn't impact you.
There's only so many you can count, I guess. Or, well, it's again cultural beliefs just different.
No, it's the counting. Anything more than that didn't serve a purpose to them in their nomadic culture.
Yeah.
You know, it makes perfect sense. It's like any bit of information. People could argue that today certain things don't matter to us. Like, you know, I don't know, how to weave certain types of cloth traditionally doesn't make any sense to us.
Yeah.
Because we don't need to know that. Same thing.
True enough.
All right. So last up, we did get an email actually asked us to mention this one, so we are. It is the Mists of Akuma, Imperial Matchmaker, 5th edition RPG Mega Adventure. It claims to be a 5th edition urban sandbox of 8 iconic PCs, or NPC rivals, and the Trade War Adventure Path, and the Eastern Fantasy, Noir, Steampunk, I don't even know how to pronounce that area. So that's a lot. That's a lot in one swoop.
Okay. Total disclaimer. I've played with Mike in the past, the guy who created this concept originally for Mists of Akuma. He actually ran a game online for our gaming group.
Okay.
And I had a great time. I love the environment. I love the concept. But it's basically 5th edition Ninja Scroll is the best way to describe it.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
You know, I ain't going to lie to you. Because I know the people involved in the stuff here, I am seriously tempted.
So, $10 for the PDF?
Yeah.
And a voucher to have the... Okay, so you get a voucher to actually get the... an at cost. That's not too bad. For $10.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess... and voucher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, that's mm-hmm. still not that bad for a cost. Now, where are they right now at? He's asking for a little over $8,100. He's currently at just a little over $1,200, and there's still 27 days to go.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see here because it's a fun game. I ain't gonna lie to you there, and I had a blast. And I'm probably going to throw money at it eventually. I just have to convince myself to do so. But I could see, one of my goals this year is to actually buy a lot less. You know, I kind of went through a shiny period over 2 years of Kickstarter, so now I'm kind of going, okay, I got to pick the absolute must. You know, unfortunately, one of them happened to be Flash Gordon from a few months ago, but that's not the point. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'm intrigued. And if you're listening, Mike, come on down and sell us on the game.
Yeah. All right. Wow. That's quite a... I think that covers us for this episode. What do you think?
I think so, too.
All right. So, where the hell am I at? Wow. If you have anything... Oh, actually, you know what we did not look at?
Oh, bundle holding. Duh. Yeah. Sorry, man.
Yeah, we always try to cover the bundle of holding to see if there's anything. I have... Cause I don't even know what's... let's see.
The Jovian Chronicles, I think.
I never really... That's a mecha combat. I was really never interested in that one.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine who was really big into that. You know, that and Heavy Gear. I think it's the other system.
Yeah.
I think it'd be fun to try once, but... I don't know.
I'd seen some of it in the, the stores, but I'm just like, not my thing. But I mean, obviously, if you were interested in this game, definitely the bundle of holding's the way to go for this.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I'll try any game once, but I need to find the right group to actually convince to play this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Space Mecha. If that's your jam, this is your jam.
Yep. So that said, the other one here we have, which has less than a week, the Genovian Chronicles has just under 2 weeks. Seventh C, they have a Seventh C second edition out.
Yeah.
And that's just a little under a week, mm-hmm. which is cool. I know some people that like Seventh C. I've personally never played it.
Yeah, it's one of those games I own. I backed the original Kickstarter, but I have yet to find a group to try it, you know? So I will pass judgment. You know, it seems fun, so I want to try it once, but I'm going to let other people decide whether they want to see it or not.
Well, I mean, you know, for $15, you can get the PDF for the rule book, the heroes and villains, and the 4 7C art packs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to... kick up to like $26.42, you get that plus the Nations Volume 1, Volume 2, and Pirate Nations.
Yeah, again, it's an amazing environment for swashbuckling action, and I do like the world and how they basically follow the L5R model, where different nation states have different magical systems. You know, they have a different emphasis here, but they also have different swordsman styles. There's secret societies, the whole nine yards. Like, Seven Seas looks amazing. I just need to find the right group to play it.
And then finally, they also, John Wick also has John Wick Presents, Wicked Fantasy, Houses of Blood, Weld, and more. So there's a starter collection that has Wicked Fantasy, Houses of the Bloodied, Weld, and Play Dirty, 15th Anniversary.
Okay, the only one I'm familiar with is House of the Bloodied, but John Wick, I'd love to, you know, again.
Yeah, and that's $8. That's only $8. And if you do 1825, you get that plus the big book of little games, Wicked Fantasy Companion, Blood and Honor, The Wheel Companion, The Shotgun Diaries, The Aegis Project, Houses of the Bloody Wilderness, and Play Dirty 2, Even Dirtier.
Well, again, John Wick's one of those people that even if you don't agree with anything, you know, with his style and so forth, you should study him because he is an amazing game designer. You know, you should I'll give him credit, full credit where credit is due. Like him or hate him, respect him. And I actually do kind of like him. I like his work. Like, his work in L5R alone should be worth the write-off there. Plus, he's done a lot of different games. Plus, he's responsible for Seven Seas as well.
All right. So, with that, if there's anything you want to tell us, you can send us an email at info@rpgscircus.com. You can post something on our Facebook page. You can post something on our podcast page on our website. And, of course, on our website and on Facebook, there's a link to our SpeakPipe application to send us a voicemail. So, hey, there you go. And, hey, you know what? Even if you want to just come on and join us sometime, shoot me an email where you can see what we can work out. I'd be more than happy to have other people come on and talk to us and give us their opinions on things. I think that's, I don't know if that's unique to this podcast, but that's kind of one of my tenets for a long time of this podcast is if you want to come on and talk, I'm more than happy to have you on and, you know, we'll see what we can do.
Yep.
Is that unique?
Well, sorry?
I don't know. I always figured, is that unique? I mean, I always ask the listeners if they were in a, you know, not always, but I'm always reminded every once in a while, like, hey, you know, if you do want to come on and talk on this show, I'd be more than happy. Shoot me an email and we'll see what we can work out. I don't know.
Oh, heck.
I don't know very many podcasts that have had that offer extended all the time.
Yeah, that's true. Well, heck, that's how I got on the show in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's how I keep having co-hosts because obviously, well, it's my podcast. I'm the only one that keeps it going, but you know, we've had a lot of obviously co-hosts come and join, and I love it because every single co-host we've ever had has brought in a new point of view, new topics, new things to talk about, new opinions, and I love it. It's what helps me keep this podcast going. I will be blunt. Without the co-host, this podcast would be nothing.
Yeah. Well, dude, you started this a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away at this point.
9 years.
Without the new blood, you basically have said everything you need to say. Like, that's the thing you'll notice about podcasts and shows. You get to a point where you run out of things to say.
Well, and that's why every once in a while I look back and I'm like, am I going to continue this podcast? Is there still interesting things to say? And we're covering new topics. Are we recovering old topics? But are there new people with new opinions? That's important to me. So that's the important thing, you know? I mean, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't like, I like to talk, so there you go.
So. Well, you like to talk and you like gaming. That's why you do it.
Yep. All right. And with that, I will bid everyone adieu until next time. How's that sound?
Sounds good. And tell us about your favorite character type.
Exactly. So we'll see everyone in about 2 weeks.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.